call the Senate Judiciary Committee to order. Welcome, everyone. Today is Restitution Day. We have a number of bills dealing with the Department of Justice restitution system. And to start out our conversation today, we will hear a number of bills. But before we do that, we're going to have a very brief work session. We're going to open a work session for the purpose of measure introduction. Work session over. Senator Beyer.
Madam Chair, I would like to introduce LC 1243, LC 1349, and LC 1987 to be printed as bills.
Senator Beyer has moved that the previously mentioned LCs be introduced as Senate Judiciary bills. Are there any objections? Any discussion?
For the record, LC 1987 is at the request of the Oregon Bankers. I'm sorry, I didn't see that on.
Thank you, Senator Beyer, for clarifying that. Any discussion? Any objections? So ordered. Okay, now we'll open a public hearing on Senate Bill 126, Senate Bill 127, 128, 129, 30, 131, 132, and 133. And we will start out our conversation today by calling Attorney General Hardy Myers and Fred Boss and Cynthia Stinson to give us an overview.
Madam Chair, members, for the record, Hardy Myers, Attorney General, and thank you for the opportunity to make some very brief opening remarks as you get underway with the consideration of these proposals from the Restitution Reform Task Force. I apologize in advance for excusing myself after I finish, but we have a full Oregon Law Commission meeting this afternoon to try to complete its judgment, its agenda for the regular session.
You have a lot of work to do over there, so we excuse you.
The Restitution Reform Task Force was formed by me in the 2001-2003 biennium, and it was incubated primarily by interaction with our Crime Victims Assistance Section and by reports that that section probably received more expressions of victim dissatisfaction with regard to the restitution component of the criminal justice system than with any other. And so, as a result of that interaction, the task force came into being, and for the 2003, first in the 2003, again in the 2005, and again today in the 2007 session, has come forward with a succession of proposals for what we think are improvements in the law of restitution in Oregon. I'm very grateful, as I think are all those who participated in this work through the three biennia, for the generally favorable response that the Legislative Assembly has given to the proposals heretofore. And this set of proposals, as with the previous ones, are really efforts to incrementally improve the law of restitution in Oregon, to address some problem in that law that we believe deserves the Legislative Assembly's attention and favorable action. And so I would simply conclude, Madam Chair, by saying that I sincerely hope that, as a whole, the proposals that are coming now before you will be seen by the committee indeed as sound and good policy proposals for the improvement of Oregon's law of restitution, and we appreciate the committee's consideration of them. Thank you very much.
Are there questions from the committee before we lose Attorney General Myers? Thank you very
much.
Thank
you, Madam Chair.
Welcome.
My name is Cynthia Stinson. I'm the director of the Crime Victims Assistance Section with the Department of Justice. I have some written materials here for you all. Thank you. I just want to give a few comments about the importance of restitution to victims of crime. In all of the criminal justice proceedings, what we hear from victims is that often restitution, the collection and awarding of restitution to victims is one of the most significant pieces that can happen in the criminal justice system, even sometimes more so than sentencing and jail time for offenders. And often that's because a victim has incurred an actual monetary loss from a theft or burglary. or because of a physical injury, they've incurred some costs. So we hear time and time again that the best thing that can happen for victims is, number one, for restitution to be ordered at the time of sentencing from the court, and then for Oregon to have a very competent system for collecting that restitution and distributing it to victims. So what I've handed out to you is just a brief history about the Restitution Reform Task Force and the names of the committee members, and also a quick sheet. This is just for your information, a quick sheet that we put together for DAs and their victim assistance programs on how restitution works, a quick reference sheet. But again, what I want to stress is that for victims, the most important thing, of course, is that they get some kind of justice, and victims often see that as restitution being ordered. And also to remember that any time restitution isn't ordered, when an offender isn't ordered to pay, then essentially we're ordering victims to repay again for the crime that was committed against them. So the work of the task force has been very successful and very important. We're happy to be a part of that as a crime victims assistance section, and we hope that you will support these bills as they move through the process. And with that, I'll hand it over to my colleague, Mr. Voss.
Thank you. Chair Burdick, members of the committee, my name is Fred Voss, and I am Chief Counsel of the Civil Enforcement Division of the Oregon Department of Justice. And I'm here to testify in support of the 8 bills from the Attorney General's Restitution Reform Task Force. In order to put these 8 bills into context, I'd like to provide a little bit of the statutory background of the Restitution Reform Task Force. Fundamentally, though, as my colleague stated, that the key premise that the task force is working from is that restitution is extremely important to victims of crime. And when it is not paid promptly, the victims actually do feel re-victimized. This is such an important concept. It's actually in our Oregon Constitution that the requirement that victims are promptly paid restitution. As the Attorney General stated, the Attorney General's Restitution Reform Task Force convened in 2002. In the 2003 legislative session, it introduced Senate Bill 617, which has since been codified at ORS 137-106. That bill brought about a fundamental sea change in the whole concept of restitution. Up to that point, for many years, the purpose of restitution, or the focus of restitution, had been on the rehabilitation of the defendant. What 617 did was that it changed the emphasis to making the victim whole. So one of the aspects of Senate Bill 617 is it required the full amount of restitution to be awarded as a judgment. Up to that point in time, the focus had been on the defendant's ability to pay. The ability to pay was no longer, after 2003, was no longer the focus of the inquiry. You would find out, was there a victim of crime? How much, what were the economic damages suffered by that victim as a result of the crime? And then the full amount was to be awarded as a judgment, a restitution judgment. The ability to pay did come into play, but the burden of proof was on the defendant to come forward and prove that the defendant did not have the present ability to pay the judgment in full and to seek a payment plan, which the court could then authorize. Fundamental focus, a fundamental change that was different, and the bills that we have, or many of the bills that have flowed from the 2003 session and from this Senate Bill 617, have continued to carry out in the law that fundamental sea change. In 2005, two bills were passed, one that clarified the definitions of what type of damages could be awarded and further defined victims, and another extended the judgment remedies for the collection of restitution. With that background, I think we can move to the individual bills if that suits the committee.
We will do that. This is the maiden voyage of our counsel, Darian Stanford here, who has summarized these bills for the committee members, and now we'll summarize them for everyone here. Before he starts, I will also point out that our very own Senator Prusansky has been a member of this task force, and thank you for your service on this. Mr. Stanford, we will now talk about open a hearing on Senate Bill 126.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members of the committee. Senate Bill 126 deals with the person's ability to set aside an adult conviction or expunge a juvenile conviction. Under present law, there is no specific prohibition that says all restitution or compensatory fines have to be paid before you can do this. Expungement or setting aside means it's as if that conviction never happened. What Senate Bill 126 does is it says you cannot get a conviction set aside or expunged until restitution and or compensatory fines are paid.
Okay, and you are the first two people signed up, so why don't you just stay here and give your testimony on 126. Thank you. And you'll need to introduce yourself again for the record.
Chair Burdick, members of the committee, my name is Fred Boss. I am Chief Counsel of the Civil Enforcement Division of the Oregon Department of Justice. I'm here to testify in support of Senate Bill 126. I have submitted written testimony. As stated, Senate Bill 126 prohibits the setting aside of an adult conviction or expunging a juvenile record if there is an unsatisfied compensatory fine or restitution judgment. Senate Bill 126 plugs a loophole that is in the current law. It is a requirement that the defendant pay restitution, but there is no requirement that the restitution be paid prior to the expungement or the setting aside of the adult criminal conviction. So that element of restitution reform did not make it into the expungement statute or the setting aside portion of the statute. We are merely bringing that forward and putting it into those particular statutes. This actually is codifying the present practice in many counties, but we just wanted to make sure that it was authorized by statute.
Okay. Are there questions from the committee? Pretty straightforward. Did you want to add something, Cynthia?
Chair Burdick, I merely am here to support my colleague, Mr. Boss. My comments were to the package of the bills.
Okay.
Thank you.
Appreciate that. If there are no questions, we'll move on to our next witness, David Rogers, for the Partnership for Safety and Justice.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Members of the committee, my name is David Rogers, and I'm the Executive Director of Partnership for Safety and Justice. We're an organization that was founded in 1999, and we're a multifaceted statewide advocacy organization. Our work is designed to make a more effective criminal justice system, one that's just and more effectively creates the types of safe communities we want to live in. Our work builds the leadership and voice of people most affected by the criminal justice system and most affected by crime, violence. We include survivors of crime, people convicted of crime, and the families of both. We're the first grassroots advocacy organization in the country that I know of that unites all of these constituencies, and we're committed to continuing this approach. We believe it's actually an important strategy and offers a holistic perspective and an effective strategy at shifting the criminal justice system towards more effective approaches to creating community safety. We oppose Senate Bill 126. At issue is not the need to find ways to better facilitate and encourage payment of restitution to crime victims. As an organization partially made up of crime survivors, and as a crime survivor myself, we fundamentally believe that the system of restitution to crime victims should be maintained and strengthened. We believe that Senate Bill 126 is a step in the wrong direction and could actually weaken the restitution system. Essentially, the bill tries to create an incentive for defendants to pay court-ordered restitution by removing defendants' ability to get their convictions set aside and, in the case of juveniles, their records expunged. What needs to be considered is that expunging criminal records, when allowed by law, actually increases the likelihood of gainful decreases the likelihood of gainful employment, and therefore increases the likelihood that defendants can pay restitution. In the past couple of years, there's been nationwide attention to barriers that people with past felony convictions experience, and access to employment rises to the top. One study showed that people with a criminal record can be 2 to 3 times more likely to be denied employment. We also know this to be true from our own research. This past fall, we released a report called Access Denied in Oregon, a report on the barriers faced by people with a past felony conviction in Oregon. We used a range of traditional research methods to collect information for the report, including surveying almost 400 people with a past felony conviction. And 77% of respondents answered yes when asked if they had ever been denied employment because of their criminal record. Setting aside conviction records and expunging juvenile records is a useful tool in helping people avoid some of the barriers they face when they have a public criminal record. By doing so, it helps defendants build healthy and sustainable lives where they actually have the resources to pay restitution and any other debts they may owe. So we strongly believe that by removing people's ability to set aside conviction records and juvenile sanction records, it is much less likely those people will find gainful employment. Paying restitution will then be like getting water from a stone. It is in the best interest of crime victims for defendants to get their lives back on track. Although we wholeheartedly support strengthening the restitution system, we think SB 126 is the wrong strategy and could make matters worse. Thanks for your consideration.
Questions? Senator Walker.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I appreciate your testimony, Mr. Rogers. I understand it, but I have a couple of questions, and I think Mr. Boss or Ms. Denson, is it, would be able to answer it. I've been looking at the compensatory fine and unitary assessment reference sheet that's sitting here at the dais for us, and the fines for felonies is quite large, $500,000 for murder, but that's not something that someone is typically going to have expunged from their record. So then I went down to look at fines for misdemeanors and some of these other things and unitary assessments. I can't really tell of these things what people would choose to expunge, but if you could answer for me, please, what would be the average size of the fine or compensatory fine or any other kind of restitution that's been ordered that would be ordered to pay for an adult and a juvenile, so I can understand this, if this is insurmountable? And before you answer that, let me also say that I'm reading here that due process requires the court to consider the financial resources of a defendant for payment of a fine. And the ability of them to pay it on installment. So let me ask then my question, what do you think would be the average fine? Of course, it's going to vary pretty substantially, but what's the average size?
Chair Burdick and Senator Walker, I think it really depends on the case.
Right.
So often the restitution reflects the kind of damage and the cost per se of the crime, and so it really would vary, and that would be on top of any unitary assessments that would be levied.
And may I follow up, Madam Chair?
Please do.
So the unitary assessments are assessed by the court, and the restitution is as well. Isn't that correct? And would the court not also be inclined to follow due process when setting the restitution awards?
Chair Burdick, Senator Walker, that's correct. And one important piece about the kind of education the Restitution Reform Task Force has been doing and the work of the legislation that's been passed is to really dispel the myth that defendants are often unable to pay restitution. There's been some real innovative practices happening around the state where the DA's office and the advocates that work there are looking into the actual assets of offenders. And let's say if someone has two vehicles, then they might be asked to sell one of them to pay their restitution, and other kind of creative ways to pay restitution. So I think in the past there has been an understanding that people that are convicted of a crime in order to pay restitution just simply cannot do it. But there are ways to set up payment plans and to work with those offenders to find a way to pay the restitution. And that is, in fact, part of the consequences of committing a crime. And that's what we want to make sure remains with this bill would say that you cannot complete every part of your sentence except the restitution and then be able to expunge your record. It says that this is an integral part of the sentence, and it's an important piece that needs to be repaid.
Chair Burdick, Senator Walker, may I clarify that answer for...
Please do.
For the assessment of restitution, the court does not consider the financial resources of the defendant and the burden that it would place. It's a two-step approach. The court reviews the evidence of an economic damage presented to the court. And so the person's car was stolen and they say it was worth X. The judgment of restitution is then awarded for the complete amount of that economic damage suffered by the crime victim. Mm-hmm. Where ability to pay comes into to play is that the next step, if the defendant comes forth and they have the burden of proof, if they say the $10,000 for that automobile, I don't have the ability to pay that 100% right now. By statute is due and payable right now. However, I can pay $50 a month. The court then can set up a payment plan to pay down that judgment at whatever the court deems to be the appropriate payment plan, or the court may delegate that payment plan to the appropriate the supervising authority. And we have another bill that addresses what is that. Okay. So due process, a compensatory fine is in the matter of a punishment. And it is akin in the civil side to punitive damages. So that is, it's different. There is a difference between a compensatory fine whose purpose is punishment and restitution whose purpose is to make the victim whole.
So, Madam Chair, that brings up my final question. Thank you. So then Mr. Rogers does have a bit of a point. If there's no due process concern by the court in terms of your ability to pay when setting economic damages or restitution, if you're making a minimum wage job and you've totaled someone's car that's worth $30,000, most likely your restitution will be $30,000, and a minimum wage job will be pretty difficult to pay that back over time. But there are consequences. You're saying there are consequences to your actions, and you should be responsible for that, correct?
Chair Burdick, Senator Walker, yes. And there is a lengthier period of time for payment. It's a policy decision on who should bear the consequences of the crime, the perpetrator of the crime or the victim of the crime, and the consequences in prior legislative sessions the legislature has determined it would be on the perpetrator of the crime.
Is there any method you could think of that would allow a binding legal responsibility after expungement had taken place? For example, maybe provide some compensation before a person is eligible for expungement, but also have a requirement that after expungement takes place. Is there any way you can bind them? Senator Pruzanski.
Madam Chair, just for clarification, the way I've read what the restitution task force has brought forward is really for clarification, because when you look at line 7 on page 1, it basically says that a person after 3 years, you got 3 years before you, after convictions, you can, before you can actually apply for expungement. And it basically says that you fully complied with and performed the sentence of the court. And part of the sentence is restitution.
Correct.
Now, normally what you see in these situations is a person doesn't have the ability to pay all of their fines or costs and whatever restitution has been applied, and there's going to be a monthly payment. The court has jurisdiction for 5 years of probation, and then in some cases can up it one more year depending on the circumstance or situation that you have. So because of that, they're going to be paying. What they're saying and what this bill would say is just make it clear to all courts and everyone that before someone is actually able to take this completely off the record and not show that they've ever been convicted of that crime, they're going to have to finish that obligation of paying that restitution, and which is really what we have done through our legislative process. Instead of requiring the victim to file an independent civil suit for that out-of-pocket cost, it's kind of like call it a one-stop. And that court, if they deem it appropriate, and that the whatever the money judgment would be in a civil proceeding for the loss of that out-of-pocket cost, they're just going to incorporate that into the sentence as part of it. So, I mean, it seems to me what we're just saying is that before you get the benefit of taking and cleaning your record off completely, you will have to fulfill that obligation. And because you could, in fact, be off of probation before the expungement would even be allowed. You would be off probation, actually, because it's going to be 3 years after that. And you still would have these obligations. And it's just making certain that before you actually clean your record, you have that one other obligation, which is the restitution. The other part that maybe Mr. Boss might want to give us is the formula that's used of how, when a payment is made to the court, and what order they're paid out. Because if I remember correctly, I think restitution is number one or second after the first.
Yeah.
And so that's one part you may want some clarity. But restitution, they're not going to be applying these monies coming in to multiple different obligations. It is, has a very high priority, so it should actually be bought down, paid down quicker than some of the other obligations.
Yeah, and my concern here is that the effect of this is it would make the expungement available to some sooner than others based on how they started out economically before they committed the crime. That's what I'm struggling with. Did you want to say something, Mr. Ross?
Chair Burley, just to clarify what Senator Brzezinski was saying, that the compensatory fines do have category number one, so the, every dollar that comes in is applied to reduce the compensatory fine, and restitution is a category two, that is shared with category three, so if a dollar comes in, 50 cents goes to restitution, and then 50 cents goes to pay the unitary assessments. So that's kind of how the distribution scheme works.
I see. So if what does that mean in effect? If someone wanted expungement, if they put in enough money to satisfy the restitution, in effect, this also requires them to satisfy the unitary fund as well, doesn't it? Because 50 cents goes one place, 50 cents goes the other. So basically, it's not just restitution, it's everything.
It would be compensatory fines and restitution. The in that second level of payment where you have category two and category three, the restitution may be larger than the unitary assessment. So we would be paying down the unitary assessment. Then once that obligation or obligations to the state have been satisfied, then they would be devoted fully to the restitution. That's the way I understand it works.
Okay, so and you're saying that the court has some discretion on the compensatory fine, and do they have discretion on the unitary part of the fine? But they don't have discretion on the restitution. The restitution is a one-for-one estimate of the actual damage suffered by the victim?
Chair Burdick, that is correct.
All right. Mr. Rogers, did you want to add anything to that?
Well, just that, if I may, I think that if we were looking for a particularly victim-centered approach to this, we'd probably question the formula in which, you know, the money from defendant is paid off and prioritize restitution a little bit more than actually the state's fines and fees. And I think that that's probably something that would to be examined. In that instance, actually, crime survivors would get more help faster.
Okay. Can anybody come up with some bright idea to keep a binding financial commitment after expungement? Because if you believe what Mr. Rogers has said, someone's income ability actually goes up after the expungement takes place. And so it would seem like a win-win situation if there was some way of pulling it off. Is there any way that that can be carried over in a binding way after expungement?
I could respond to that.
Sandy
if
Walker.
You like. In bankruptcy court, people discharge their debts, and they often, when they discharge their debts, reaffirm a debt that survives the discharge. So they can pay on a Chapter 13 or a Chapter 7 and get a discharge, and then there are certain debts that they have chosen not to discharge, and they continue paying, and the payment survives. And if they don't make payment, then the creditor has all the rights and responsibilities it had before the bankruptcy to go after the debtor to pay the debt. So it seems that if you were thinking along these lines, you could do the same thing, get an expungement, but a reaffirmation of the restitution agreement, and make it a binding legal obligation of the debtor, or defendant in this case.
Chair Burdick, we could simply have the setting aside or the expungement not apply to any outstanding obligation.
Well, let's think about something along those lines as we consider this bill. Senator Beyer?
Thank you, Madam Chair. In the example that Senator Walker just brought up, someone who is an expert on bankruptcy law will be able to answer this, but if contracts, which would, in a sense this would become a contract between two private parties to pay this debt, but if that person was then to file bankruptcy, that contract becomes in effect null and void because the person has now been, their record has been expunged, and they file bankruptcy, so that gets rid of the obligation to pay the debt, so the victim is then holding the bag, so to speak.
And, Madam Chair, Senator Breyer is exactly right, because fines and restitutions are not dischargeable in bankruptcy court. But when you convert that from a restitution order to just a reaffirmation or a loan or a debt, it does become eligible for discharge. Even though you say it doesn't, the court doesn't care. It's what Congress said, and it's what the statutes here say. Interesting.
Are there other questions, comments? Senator Cruz.
Yeah, I guess as I read this, I'm just wondering if the conviction has been been expunged and the person's off probation and they have not paid what the court said they were going to pay, what remedy is available?
Contempt of court.
Tip for the court. There's no remedy available, is there, at that point?
Burdick, Senator Cruz, I don't believe so.
Okay, which is the point, which is why this is here, so the sentence is carried out, I think, you know, and quite honestly, to satisfy the victim of the crime on a financial basis is what this is all about, I would think. I mean, I looked at this, I saw this is pretty straightforward in my opinion. This measure.
I think what I'm struggling with here is that it's just those cases where you have a very, very poor criminal and a victim who's got a large damage. And if maybe there would be, so if the criminal is not capable because of his record of getting a well-paying job, then nobody wins. So I'm just wondering if there's some kind of balancing test you could have a judge do to require require as a condition of expungement that all the restitution agreements be fulfilled. If he's signed up for $50 a month, then part of qualifying for the expungement is making all those payments on time, because the ability to pay is considered in that agreement. And then as if there could be some kind of judicial discretion to make a reasonable payment to a victim as a condition of expungement, but maybe not require it to be the full amount. I mean, I certainly agree with the premise that the victim should be fully compensated. I don't think that's at issue at all here. But if, as you're balancing the actual ability on the ground of somebody to make this payment, if there would be some kind of safety valve you could put in.
Chair Burdick, there is that for juveniles. And in order for, if we go back to what is a satisfaction of the debt in the case of a juvenile, the juvenile can, if they stay out of trouble, if they make their payments that they're supposed to be making, if they pay a certain portion of the debt, then they can be, upon application of the court and then finding of these, I think it's like 10 elements, but basically staying out of trouble making the payments. If they do that, then they can make an application to the court for a satisfaction of the restitution obligation. And what Senate Bill 126 says is that in order to apply for expungement, your restitution must be satisfied. So that it is handled that way in the juvenile system.
Well, I'm confused.
Senator Walker.
Yeah, I'm confused, Madam Chair, because that's what I'm thinking. I took the adult part out of it. It's easy for me to say, as an adult, you don't get your expungement if you haven't paid your bills. But I'm looking at a kid. You know, my neighbor kid takes my brand new car out for a joyride, which I think it costs $28,000 for this little hybrid car. And he takes it out for a joyride and smashes it and totals it. So now that's $28,000 of restitution. Likely my insurance covers that, but then the insurance company can go after the juvenile as a subrogation right and collect from the juvenile. So now how is this little 16-year-old going to pay off a $28,000 debt? Which is my concern. But you're just now saying that you can get the juvenile to pay on it partially and then go to the court and petition and say, I have partially satisfied this judgment. Can you now say it's paid in full, and then under this bill the person could apply for expungement and be expunged?
Chair Burdick, Senator Walker, yes.
Okay.
Okay.
So now I'm happy. I'm getting happier here.
Senator Walker, that's my goal.
Yeah, because that's just my concern. I'm worried about these kids who make really stupid mistakes. Adults do too, but, you know, kids are kids, and they need to learn from it, but they also don't need to be burdened with their whole life of trying to fix this mistake.
Senator Walker, in 2003, when we were debating, or when there was the debate on Senate Bill 617, there was exactly that concern, and it was in, we amended Senate Bill 617 that did not have that type of a satisfaction provision, but because various senators were concerned with that, the issue of the juvenile that burns down the warehouse and has $1 million obligation out there, we put in a particular type, a method of satisfaction for those who are in the juvenile system. And it is basically what I laid out, is that they not commit other crimes, they make essentially a good faith effort to make the payments, and or they pay a certain percentage of the total debt outstanding. There may be some other ones that is in the juvenile code.
Okay. Thank you for clarifying that and making me happier.
Okay, thank you. We're going to close the public hearing on this bill. We will consider it for a work session later. Let me ask you, Mr. Boss, you're signed up for all these bills. Does it matter what order we take them in?
Chair Burdick, no.
Okay, I think we're going to go a little out of order here to accommodate witnesses. We have some people who told whoppers on this. For example, somebody from the Justice Department said that they came from the Department of Justice said they came from more than 100 miles away. I doubt that.
they took a wrong turn somewhere.
And even worse, even just as bad, somebody from the Multnomah County DA's office. Now, I ride that every day. It's roughly 50 miles. Anyway, we will take... we will move right now to Senate Bill 129. Counsel.
Thank you, Chair Burdick and members of the committee. Senate Bill 129 has to do with the amount of bail that a defendant posts or that is posted for a defendant. It does a number of things. One, it requires a court in setting bail to consider the potential for any restitution award and the potential amount of that reward. Presently, that's not one of the statutory criteria that a court considers in setting bail. It also requires that if the court decides to release bail to a defendant who has complied with his conditions of his or her release, the court needs to make a specific finding that a restitution award is unlikely. And the idea then would be that what else the bill does is establishes a mechanism for that bail to be applied towards the restitution awards.
Mr. Boss.
Chair Burdick, members of the committee, my name is Fred Boss. I am the Chief Counsel of the Civil Enforcement Division of the Oregon Department of Justice. I am here to testify in support of Senate Bill 129. Senate Bill 129 would say, as stated, would require the money posted as a bail to be applied to pay the criminal money judgment in a particular case. In many instances, these are the only monies available for a victim to have the restitution judgment satisfied. So it's very important that this money be able to be used to satisfy the outstanding criminal judgment. This, as the other one we discussed, is actually the practice in several counties in the state, and this would codify the practice, the current practice in some of the counties. Now, I've spoken with the folks at the Oregon Judicial Department. They do seek various, some clarifications in this concept or in this bill. Number one, they are concerned that in the initial bail setting hearing, where the judge is to consider the likelihood of an award of restitution, that this may lengthen that hearing. They are also concerned that in the phrase where it states that a portion of the security amount and bail is referred to as that's the slang term more or less for security, that a portion of the security amount be applied to any unsatisfied monetary obligation as described in ORS 137-295, that would not be read to challenge or to any way alter the order of payment that I've described before, that is Category 1, Category 2, and Category 3. It's certainly not intended to do that, but they want to make sure that that is clear in the law.
Well, if it's not intended to do that, then how does that work? Then you'd have to... I don't understand if it's not intended to do that, how you avoid that.
This language that is in 4A is, I believe, only intended to describe what obligations are going to be satisfied. However, we would not oppose any amendment that would clarify that is what it is. Its intent. Its intent is not to alter any form of the category, of the method of distribution of the funds.
Senator Walker.
You know, these all seem so simple and straightforward right at first. And then I start thinking of the little scenarios. So let me tell you the scenario that came out of my head while you were talking. What if some elderly mom had to take out a second mortgage on her house to bail her son out of jail, pending trial, and then the trial, you know, he's found guilty and he has to pay a judgment, and they take that poor little mom's second mortgage money and applies it to this guy's bail. You know, she loses all her money.
Senator Walker, that certainly is her choice. And in those counties that do have this practice, it's my understanding that that is posted, and people who sign the agreement posting the money are informed and are notified that this money is gone if the person is convicted, that it will be applied to the outstanding obligation. Now, currently in the law, it can be also applied to child support, and this would not alter that. So under the situation that you described, if the person, the incarcerated person, has outstanding child support obligations, then that money would be taken to satisfy that also.
Okay, I have a follow-up question, Madam Chair.
Please follow up.
Thank you. I can't recall in Oregon, I don't think we have them, the bail bonds people, that you can go to the bail bondsman and get them to pay your debt, and you're pretty much indebted to the baseball kneecapper kind of guy. Do we have those in Oregon?
No.
I didn't think so. So when you start taking people's money that, you know, they're trying to help somebody out and it's not their debt, I think you're going to find there's going to be a lot of people sitting in jail. Isn't that right? That would be a question.
Well, more likely you're going to have people that have put the money up, out that money, and they're going to be talking to their kinfolk or whoever they put the money up for and saying, you know, you need to pay back this money. I mean, our courts, the courts that I deal with, they do that. I mean, they give notice and potentially that security amount. I mean, we made a decision in the legislature, through the legislative process, not to allow for bail, but instead security. So it's kind of an internal operation as compared to having the mailman with the kneecapper and all that in the middle.
They have them in other states.
They do.
No.
Well, I am kind of sympathetic to the idea of the scenario that you mentioned, because I'm sure the son is going to tell his mom, I didn't do it, I'm going to be found innocent. And okay.
Chair Burdick, the funds would be forfeit if he is convicted and a restitution judgment, a criminal money judgment, is entered.
Okay, well, I didn't notice a notice requirement in here. I think if this bill were to move forward, it would have to have a very, very strong notice requirement in it that people providing bail would have to have. And then the issue becomes, you know, how can you make sure that the notice gets the right person? Because if the mom gives the son the money...
No, it won't happen that way. Madam Chair, if you want something like that, then what you need to do is just set the point of where the security is posted. Whoever's posting that security would have to sign an affidavit, not an affidavit, but a document that would state, I am aware that this money could, if my friend, family gets convicted, be applied to whatever outstanding costs are through the judgment or something like that.
And this is, I haven't bailed anybody out lately, but if someone does want to, don't worry, Senator Pruszynski, I'll be there for you.
Thank you.
unless this bill passes, of course. Got it. But in a case like that, just as a question, if someone were to be bailed out, would there be a situation where the money could be given to them and they would sign the affidavit? In other words, is there a scenario by which, is there a foolproof way that you can make sure that the person who's actually providing the money is hunted down and required to sign this affidavit?
Chair Burdick, I would think that we could devise something.
Madam Chair, I just want to follow up on that. I think that obligation for whoever was going to receive the money to know exactly where that source of money came from is not going to be happening. It's the person that actually takes the money, puts it on the counter, and says, here's the security for this person. That person is the one that we would be able to get a signature on a document. The money may have actually come from the mom who's in the wheelchair who can't make it down to the...
I didn't have the wheelchair in there.
But I just threw that in.
This is a very creative community.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I guess I had a question, and maybe I was reading this bill wrong, but the question I had at first was if the magistrate or the whoever it is has to determine the likelihood of restitution, I was afraid that may cause them to set lower bails, because I was reading as this language saying that if there's going to be a higher amount of restitution required, the bail has to be set lower so that the person could potentially pay both. But you've described a different scenario. So was I reading the words incorrectly, or is that a possibility with the language that's in here?
Chair Burdick, Senator Breyer, it certainly is the intent of the bill that the initial bail amount be large enough to encompass the likelihood of an awarded restitution judgment. And currently, the magistrate considers the likelihood of flight, that likelihood that the person's going to show up. In addition, this bill would impose upon the court the obligation to also consider the likelihood of a restitution judgment, and then how much that would be when setting the amount of the bail. I would think from that it would flow that it would be higher. Or it could be the same amount. I mean, if a person has a high likelihood of fleeing, or if it's a violent crime, they may want to post at $250,000, which may be more than enough to cover the restitution award.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and appreciate that clarification, because that's what you described, and I just read this differently, and as long as we're clear what it does.
Thank you. Okay, Senator Cruz.
Yeah, Mr. Boss, you said that the Justice Department had concerns with the language, correct?
Chair Burdick, Senator Cruz, the Oregon Judicial Department?
Judicial Department. I guess I'm concerned because I looked at the task force, and there's members of the Judicial Department on the task force. So are we going to see a lot of these where they have helped create something that they have issues with?
Chair Burdick, Senator Cruz.
Question, Senator Cruz.
I believe it just in the LC draft, they helped create the concept, but the draft, the wording, you know, the devil is in the details sometimes.
So it's Scribner's interpretation, more or less. Okay. Madam Chair, I find it interesting that people who help draft something have concerns with what they've drafted. But
and that's a first in our process.
I understand. But I figured this lawyer-to-lawyer stuff ought to work easier.
Oh, welcome to judiciary, Senator Cruz. Okay, thank you. Other questions? Senator Pruzanski.
This is a point of clarification. The task group, the committee itself, our work group, you have a lot of different members with different perspectives. It doesn't mean that everyone unanimously agrees to any of these. And when you start looking and fleshing some stuff out, I mean, one of the things I think the Judicial Department would have some other concern about is that now they're going to have to make this judgment as to whether or not restitution is going to be part of the potential judgment that would be entered if the person is convicted. And then you have to figure out how to evaluate what that restitution amount is. Clearly, in many cases, if the person has insurance, so I say if it involves an automobile and they have insurance, the insurance is probably going to cover it. But then the question is, you know, is the judge, he or she, going to know whether or not there's a means for that restitution? So there's a lot of other components there.
As I believe that, I don't believe that's admissible, whether someone has insurance.
Sure, I don't believe it is, but... I don't know whether it would or would not, that would preclude it in the bail hearing. But one, Chair Burdick, one other
issue that the Judicial Department had was that they would like to ensure that the reading of this bill would be that if they're the first amount of money from the bail be applied to the criminal money judgment arising from that case, but if there's any left over, if the person has other criminal money obligations, that it be it go to pay those obligations and not returned back to the criminal.
Now, you mentioned the Judicial Department a couple times, but there's nobody signed up. Is there anybody here from the...
Mr. Travis is
okay.
In the
back. I think we're going to put this on hold a little bit, take our other witnesses. Thank you. Amy L. Kenich from OCDLA, and I probably murdered your name.
That was close enough.
Was it? Good.
Amy L. Kenich from Oregon Criminal Defense Lawyers Association. Madam Chair, you'll have to excuse me. This is my first time testifying, although probably not my last. And I'd like to speak to Senate Bill 129. And we have some of the same concerns as the Judicial Department has. And we'd also like to talk about some of the practical effects of Section 1. And I forgot my bill. That Section 1, Subsection 1, has on the criminal justice system. I'd like to remind the committee that the Oregon Constitution guarantees that bail not be excessive. And one of the concerns that we have in this situation is that when you tack on the potential of a large restitution amount, you may be heading towards an amount that is considered excessive. I think this goes towards what Senator Beyer spoke to, which is the potential of the courts taking that constitutional issue into account and actually lowering the amount on either the security amount or the restitution amount to reach a number that is not considered excessive or that the court would not consider excessive. So I don't necessarily think that was a misreading, only a possibility that, frankly, we hadn't considered, but I think is a likely possibility in some scenarios to happen. I'd like to talk to the committee about what a bail hearing looks like. 135.245 statutorily requires that security be set immediately or that the defendant appear in front of a magistrate to set that security amount. Additionally, the judge must set that security amount within 48 hours of the arraignment. We discussed what the practical effect would be if you have to make a restitution determination at the time of the security determination. So if you go into arraignment, I'm going to use Multnomah County since that's most recently where I've practiced. You go into an arraignment, and there's 50 people there, and there's a bunch of people in custody, and you have one attorney handling all of those. The judge arraigns a defendant and says security is set at $10,000 if it's a Class C felony, and you move on to the next person. Well, if you take the scenario where there's additional restitution, that would require, in our interpretation of Section 1, that the judge, as was said, that it's a mandate. The judge must take that or shall take into consideration the restitution amount. And that would require that the district attorney have had contact with the victim by that time and would have some sort of likely amount in mind to be able to present to the judge. Our concern is that that is a very difficult thing to require the district attorney to be able to present at that stage of the proceedings. Additionally, that it would present quite a burden on the defense attorney, who may or may not disagree with that amount, to argue that that is usually the first time a defense attorney is meeting their client. They don't necessarily have any of the information. They probably don't have the police reports, and they have no way at that stage in the proceeding when security is usually set to argue for or against that restitution amount being included. The logical next step for that is that an additional hearing would have to be set. There are a number of what we could consider fiscal impacts of that. You would have somebody who is sitting in jail for however long the hearing takes to set, maybe a week, maybe 2 weeks. How long it takes to get the police reports and investigate, that may be one of the determining issues in that. You have additional hearings that are required. So a district attorney would have to appear at that hearing. Likely some sort of pretrial supervisor would have to appear at that hearing. The defense attorney would have to appear, and it would have to be in front of a judge. And I think that I don't have any actual statistics, but I think that it's likely that there are quite a few cases where restitution is involved. So the way that this is phrased, it would require almost an additional hearing be set to determine that almost every single time you have restitution at question, or as this is said, likely. I'd like to remind the committee that 135.245, section 1, subsection 3, says the judge shall impose the least onerous requirements to ensure defendant's return. So the purpose of bail, as the Oregon criminal defense lawyers see it, is to ensure that defendant return to court. It is not meant to be a bank account for restitution. So it's not meant to be something where a defendant deposits money into that account and is just waiting and waiting to be convicted so that money can be applied to that debt. And we believe that statutorily, 135.245, section 1, subsection 3, would contradict the language, the amended language in section 1, subsection 1 of this bill. And that is a real concern that we have. We also like to remind the committee that the jail beds, and I can only speak to Multnomah County personally, but I think it is the highest volume, but it can be applied, highest volume turnover of inmates, but I think it can be applied to other counties, that jail beds are a finite resource. When I did research on how many jail beds there were, I received two different numbers, which is somewhere between 1,357 jail beds and 1,690 jail beds, and that for every person who would have bailed out, if they could have bailed out, if the number was just based on the security amount, that is one more bed that somebody has to be kicked out of. And I looked at Multnomah County has an inmate release website where you can go see who has been released or matrixed out of custody. And it is ID theft, burglary, methamphetamine possession, all the things that we want to protect the citizen from. So you have somebody who could have posted bail who's being held in custody for an additional amount of time. And those people, additional people, will need to be released to accommodate those. I was unable to find any statistics, although I'm sure they're out there somewhere, about how many people per day bail out to be able to provide the committee with an idea of how many people would have to be matrixed to accommodate them for the additional week or 2 weeks.
I think we need to wrap this up. We're running out of time here. So did you have any other issue points?
Only to comment on Senator Walker, Madam Chair, on Senator Walker's comment about the elderly mother who may or may not lose her money. And I think that that would, as we talked about, have an impact on how many people who bail out, in addition to potentially punishing somebody who's used their resources, all the resources that they have, to help out their family and community. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you very much. Are there questions from the committee?
Just one question. Regarding the bailout, I mean, in most cases, our jails are, say, full to the max just because of the resources and all that. So most of those individuals are going to be released through some type of matrix with some type of release agreement through the authority they have in that facility. Isn't that correct?
I'm sorry, I'm not sure I understood the question.
That is correct, Senator Pazansky. It's for Multnomah County.
Yeah. In other words, they're not going to sit there for months and months on a misdemeanor or even on a low-grade felony. They're going to be out because you're going to have someone else already in there based on the metric system.
That's correct. Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Our next witness is Terry Quinteros.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, my name is Terry Quinteros. I'm the Program Director for Crime Survivors for Community Safety. We're a program of partnership for safety and justice. And I'm here today to oppose Senate Bill 129 for many of the same reasons that have already been mentioned, but I just want to recap them really quickly. That even though that this may already be in practice in several different counties, that the money being held for the person accused seems to be held as if the person were already convicted of the crime, because money held is part of a punishment. And that, as was already brought up, it is often not the money of the person who is accused that is posting the bail, but rather friends and family members who are posting that bail, so they would be the ones who would risk losing out on that particular money. Also, I wanted to add that even though there are notices posted to folks when they bail someone out that they may lose that money, as someone who's worked with people in crisis for 18 years, it's hard for me to imagine that when a family member goes to bail one of their family members out, that they're really very clear at that point all of the potential consequences that lay in front of them. And essentially, we feel that this bill could create a secondary layer of victims, and that survivors absolutely deserve to receive restitution, but that most survivors would not want anyone else to be hurt in the process of their receiving restitution so that they may move on with their lives.
Thank you very much. Questions from the committee? Thank you very much for coming.
Mm-hmm. Thank you.
We'll close the hearing on Senate Bill 129. I think if you want to proceed with this, I think you've gotten some direction from the committee. Okay, now we will go out of order once more and take up Senate Bill 132. Council.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. Senate Bill 132 is an attempt to reconcile juvenile restitution law with adult restitution law. It's my understanding that over the past couple of sessions, 2003, 2005, there have been various reforms to adult restitution law, and it's not entirely clear or statutorily clear whether those changes apply in the juvenile world or not. Senate Bill 132 attempts to provide that clarity, not only for what has been enacted in past sessions, but for, in a couple of instances, what is actually being proposed in this session.
Thank you. Mr.
Boss. Chair Burdick, members of the committee, my name is Fred Boss. I am Chief Counsel of the Civil Enforcement Division of the Oregon Department of Justice. I am here to testify in support of Senate Bill 132, which would establish some adult restitution concepts in juvenile law. This is a recognition that many crimes are actually committed these days by juveniles, and that victims suffer economic damages as a result. I'll briefly go over what this bill does. It takes the adult concepts or definition of economic damages and victims and places that into the juvenile code. It also establishes the priority of payments among victims that was established last session for the adult offenders or adult defendants. It makes clear that a judgment from the juvenile court is a criminal judgment for the purposes of the judgment remedies. It makes clear that a compensatory fine can be awarded against a juvenile in lieu of restitution, which is our Senate Bill 127, which I will discuss in a moment. It makes clear that a judgment can be collected against a juvenile who is in the custody of the Oregon Youth Authority, which is Senate Bill 128, which we have proposed. It provides that if bail is posted for a juvenile, it can be forfeited to pay restitution, which was we've just discussed in Senate Bill 129. It would allow for an award of less than the full amount of restitution with the victim's consent, which will be we're also going to talk about in for adults in Senate Bill 130. And then it provides for a clear obligation to award the full amount of restitution in forms that are unique to juvenile situations called a formal accountability agreements and diversions, much like plea agreements in the adult world. The juvenile code has methods by which the juveniles can reconcile their obligations to the victim, and we wanted to make sure that restitution was part of that consideration. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Questions from the committee? Thank you. Tom Cleary, Multnomah County DA, who claims to live 100 miles away.
I apologize very much.
These are a matter of public record.
That's I-405 twice.
Even with snow detours, that's pressing it.
Probably.
Welcome to the committee.
Thank you, ma'am. Madam Chair and members of the committee, good afternoon, and thank you for the opportunity to address you today on Senate Bill 132. I'm testifying in support of that bill. I should say, for the record, I'm Tom Cleary, Senior Deputy District Attorney in Multnomah County. I have the pleasure of working in the juvenile unit at this time. Madam Chair, members of the committee, this bill really provides for recovery of restitution to victims, and it makes victims a part of our juvenile process. That is really something that all of the system partners try to do every single day out at the juvenile court in Multnomah County. We try to make victims a part of our system so that they feel a real sense of restorative justice taking place. Additionally, what it does is it benefits the youth who our system deals with. The goal of all of the system partners is to make sure, or try our best to make sure, that the youth that we deal with get the services that they need and they don't come back into the justice system, either as juveniles or adults. Victims play a very large role in that they can communicate to the youth the very real damage that is suffered as a result of delinquent behavior. Those interactions are an opportunity for the youth to hear things, quite frankly, that they've never heard before. For anecdotal example, in stolen car cases, when the judge who's taking a plea on an unauthorized use of a motor vehicle might ask the youth, did you understand when you did this act that the victim would have to find another way to take their children to school, would have to find another way to get to work, that sort of thing. And that sort of information from victims really hits home. In Multnomah County, last year, we diverted 400 cases to informal handling. What that means is a number of those will be dealt with through formal accountability agreements. This bill provides for victim input into those formal accountability agreements, which is incredibly valuable for the reasons that I've already stated. Our office, of course, does not have anything to do with those agreements. It is a contract by statute between the juvenile department and the youth. But the victim's involvement, as called for by this bill, would be very beneficial.
Thank you. Questions from the committee? Okay, Tim Lowen from the Oregon Juvenile Department Directors Association. Glad you stayed over. Welcome to the committee.
Thank you. Chair Burdick, Vice Chair Beyer, and committee members, I thank you for the opportunity to appear before you. My name is Tim Lowen. I'm the Juvenile Department Director for Yamhill County. I'm the current president of the Oregon Juvenile Department Directors Association, representing the 36 juvenile departments in the state. First of all, I want to say that we support Senate Bill 132. We believe it's a good document. We think it's helpful to the system and to victims that it represents. We do have a concern, although related to Section 2, Sub 2 of the bill. And that's where it speaks to the formal accountability agreements, as previously described, would be no longer subject to collection and distribution by the juvenile departments, but would be turned over to the authority of the court clerk. And we find this to be somewhat concerning for several reasons, one of which is that when payments are made to the juvenile department, they are immediately dispersed back to the victims involved in an offender's crime. We're concerned that if this were turned over to the court clerk, if there were other obligations to the offender, it's likely that, as described earlier in categories, that if there was other monetary obligations under Category 2 restitution or Category 3 unitary assessments and fines, that once a new entry for restitution is made, those other obligations would first have to be satisfied, the court assessments, the fines, and the other restitutions before any payments could be made to the current restitution issue under a formal accountability agreement. Secondly, we think that there's some concerns with the issue of the court clerk being able to administer this through their system. OGIN is set up to use a petition or something to enter the case. And so it's of concern that if, and in talking to our trial court office, they indicated we would probably have to go and file a petition in order to get them to be able to set up a case file so that they could begin collecting and then distributing monies, and then we'd have to come back in and dismiss the petition in order to make that happen. A third issue that we see is the possibility that because we had in 2005 almost 4,000 dispositions of formal accountability agreements, that this once turned over to the court clerk may mean a fiscal impact. They may have to be required to a greater workload, as described in Multnomah County just prior to my testimony, 400 cases there. That's likely going to mean some level of workload for that court clerk's office and an additional amount of money that we'll take to fund that sort of resource. We believe we've done a pretty good job in juvenile departments in making these payments and making sure the payments get back to the victims of those crimes. But we believe that if there is a concern with the payment to victims, that maybe a better solution might be to make sure or to state that formal accountability agreements prior to expiration or prior to termination would be subject to making sure that they either be extended for the period of time of up to 6 months, which is allowed by law currently, or that they be revoked and taken back to court so that the restitution can be ordered. That is the current practice in most all counties presently. We believe that that should be a satisfactory solution to the current bail issue that we have.
Thank you. Mr. Boss, I saw you nodding your head a little bit while he was testifying. Are these issues that he raises issues that you think could be accommodated in this bill?
Chair Burdick, yes.
Okay. Are there questions of this witness from the committee? Thank you. I'd like the two of you to work together and see if you can figure out a solution to this. Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Close the hearing on Senate Bill 132. Open the hearing on Senate Bill 130. Trying to keep the council on its toes here.
Thank you. Thank you, Chair Burdick and members of the committee. Senate Bill 130 is a mechanism that would allow a court to impose restitution in less than the amount of a victim's full economic damages, provided the victim gives written consent. There's nothing presently in the statutes that allows this, although I think Mr. Boss would say it happens with the agreement of district attorneys and such, but this would make it provide statutory authorization if the victim provides written consent. And again, we're talking about economic damages here, and economic damages refers to objectively quantifiable monetary losses. So it's your the damage to your vehicle or medical bills and such.
Okay, Mr. Boss.
Chair Burdick, members of the committee, my name is Fred Boss. I'm Chief Counsel of the Civil Enforcement Division of the Oregon Department of Justice. I'm here to testify in support of Senate Bill 130, which would amend ORS 137, 106, and allow an award of less than the full amount of economic damages as restitution. This bill would allow the victim and the court some flexibility so that the victim could have the most favorable economic outcome as far as the payment of their economic losses that result in the crime. It is an acknowledgement that the vast majority of criminal cases are satisfied with the plea bargain, and sometimes it is more advantageous for the victim to receive 50 cents on the dollar than a payment of $25 for an extended period of time. Quite often, as we've talked about,
a parent or a relative of a defendant will come in and say, I will pay the restitution obligation if you will take a lesser amount. And quite often it is in the victim's best interest sometimes to take less than the full amount. This would allow that to happen. Under the current under the law as it is written, it requires the full amount of restitution to be awarded. This would allow the victim some flexibility with their written consent, so that it does not happen without them knowing about it and without their consent.
Thank you very much. Questions from the committee? Okay, Ms. Quinteros. I'm going to listen to you one more time. I always get close on that, but never quite get it right.
All right. Chair Burdick, members of the committee, my name is Terry Quinteros, and I am the program director for Crime Survivors for Community Safety, a program of Partnership for Safety and Justice. And I'm here today to actually support Senate Bill 130. Again, I'll be brief in my comments in just saying that we believe that whenever possible, survivors should have a voice in criminal proceedings that have to do with their particular case, and we fully support this particular bill for that reason.
Thank you. Questions from the committee? Okay, close the hearing on Senate Bill 130. Open the hearing on Senate Bill 128.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members of the committee. Senate Bill 128 is relating to what lawyers sometimes term as presumptions, what the law assumes to be true unless something else is shown. Right now, the presumption is if a defendant is sentenced to pay restitution and also to some period of incarceration, the court assumes that the defendant is not able to make payments towards restitution while the defendant is incarcerated, unless the court makes a specific finding to the contrary. What Senate Bill 128 does is it shifts that presumption, and it assumes that a defendant is able to continue paying while he or she is incarcerated, unless the court makes a specific finding that the defendant is not able to pay.
Ms. Boss.
Chair Burdick, members of the committee, my name is Fred Boss. I am Chief Counsel of the Civil Enforcement Division of the Oregon Department of Justice. I'm here to testify in support of Senate Bill 128. The Senate Bill 128 provides for the collection of restitution while the defendant is incarcerated. I believe counsel correctly stated the issue here. Senate Bill 617, as codified in ORS 137-106, provides that the full amount of restitution is to be paid, and then the burden is upon the defendant to come forward and prove that they have an inability to pay. Under the current, this conflicts with the current ORS 161-675, which puts the states that if a defendant is to be incarcerated, the state must come in and prove that the defendant has the ability to pay. That this bill, Senate Bill 128, aligns the criminal law with the intent to focus, of Senate Bill 617, to focus on the victim and to put the burden of proof on the defendant to come forward and show that they do not have the burden, that they do not have the ability to pay.
Thank you. Questions from the committee? Thank you very much. Our next witness is Amy Elkinich. Mm-hmm. I think I got it right.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. Amy Elkinich for Oregon Criminal Defense Lawyers Association, and I will also try and keep this brief. As Mr. Stanford pointed out, this changes the presumption during a sentencing hearing and switches it from the state having to prove that the defendant can pay to the defendant having to prove that they cannot pay. We have two primary concerns. The first is what would happen if no finding on the record was made of this. And there are a lot of instances where such a finding can accidentally be forgotten. Our concern is that if this happens, then Department of Corrections or the supervising authority will automatically assume that payments must be made, and we're worried about the burden that that will place on defendants in the system. The second concern, and this is the primary concern, is
that wages would be taken out of inmates' salaries. So what we were envisioning was the defendant working in custody, making, and I couldn't find exactly how much, 70 cents an hour, 90 cents an hour, whatever small amount of money they make an hour, and that money would ordinarily go into their commissary, and the restitution being taken out of that amount of money that they're working on, especially when it is an indigent defendant or somebody who doesn't have other assets or means to take in order to fulfill the restitution amount. Part of the reason this is concerning is that corrections officers say that the money that is earned by inmates is a valuable tool to help control the inmate population, and it provides an incentive for an inmate to behave well, to continue working, to pursue the education, whatever programs they are involved in. So we oppose this bill primarily because of the wages being taken out of inmates' commissary, although I don't know if that was the intent for that to occur, and if there was a way to amend this or fix this so it would exclude wages earned while working in custody, we would be able to support this.
Mr. Boss.
Chair Burdick, certain wages are already exempt under certain federal programs. Also, there are certain exemptions in the garnishment statutes for a minimum of $400 for a particular garnishment. You're always allowed to have $400 in your account. And
in prison, right?
Anywhere.
Okay, so are prison wages exempt or not?
Chair Burdick, they are not. They're treated as any other wage. Mm-hmm. Having garnished prisoners, they are all fully aware of the $400 statutory exemption.
I see. So they make sure they buy their stuff.
Chair Burdick, the main, quite often, people who are incarcerated do receive inheritances. They receive tribal allotments. They even win the lotteries. So they write books. There is an assumption, and I believe an inaccurate assumption that was made under the former law that simply because you're incarcerated, you will not have an availability of money. And this addresses. Grant gives the state the ability to collect, especially in those certain unique situations where someone who is incarcerated does receive a substantial sum of money.
Senator Walker.
Yeah, thank you, Madam Chair. Okay, here I am looking at the poor little old lady again. But this one, I'm just looking at the defendant in the inmate now. We're talking about the inmate. They've been convicted. They have a commissary account. They're working for 70 cents an hour, if they're lucky. And tell me, I know, but I want you to tell me on the record, what do they have to buy when they're in prison with their commissary funds? Do any of you know the answer to that?
Chair Burdick, Senator Walker, I honestly don't know presently, and I'm not the one to testify, but I don't know whether they actually make money. I think they receive credits. And
right.
But they also... I don't know honestly what they have at the commissary.
I can tell you, Madam Chair, can I follow up?
Please, follow up. We're waiting with bated breath.
Yeah, I can tell you that those commissary funds, I don't know completely in Oregon, but I know some other states, that they're required to buy their toothpaste, their laundry detergent, and their toilet paper, and their other essential needs that they need to exist in the institution, because those things are not covered under, they're not things we give them. We expect them, I guess, to brush their teeth with baking soda. I don't know. But that's what things are used for. That's what the commissary is used for, as well as buying junk food. They have a lot of junk food in prison, by the way, but it's used for that purpose as well. So, you know, when you start paying restitution out of their commissary account, that takes away their ability to get some of these basic needs met while they're in prison. And I appreciated the comments by Ms. Alkanich about how it also takes away the ability of the prison staff to use it as a club over their head. You know, if you don't, we're going to freeze your commissary account if you don't behave. sort of thing. So that those are my thoughts.
Thank you. Senator Cruz?
Yeah, well, thank you, Madam Chair. I guess as I read this, and based on what Senator Walker said, they're lucky to make in prison if they get the good job. It's about, you know, and assume a 40-hour work week, it's about a little over $150 a month that they make. And so I guess I'm assuming at this point that if the inmate had no significant assets on the outside, that you would never be able to deduct from his inside account, simply because chances of it ever reaching the $400 threshold would be non-existent. So I guess to a degree it all depends on what assets are available inside or outside the system at this point. So I mean, clearly if somebody has those sorts of assets on the outside, they're available for them on the inside as well. So
Thank you.
A comment, Madam Chair.
Thank you. Are there any other questions or comments? Thank you very much.
Thank you.
We will close the public hearing on whatever that was, 128, and open a public hearing on
131.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members of the committee. Senate Bill 131 appears to be just providing a definition. Presently, ORS 137-106 talks about appropriate supervising authorities that have obligations relating to restitution for adult or juvenile offenders. In practice, this is persons or agencies that supervise defendants. And now this actually provides a definition for a term that's presently undefined. The definition is appropriate supervising agent authority is any state or local agency that is authorized to supervise the defendant.
Mr. Boss, I'll give prizes for brevity on this one, so see if we can get through our agenda here.
Chair Burdick, members of the committee, my name is Fred Boss. I'm Chief Counsel of the Civil Enforcement Division of the Oregon Department of Justice, and I'm here testifying in support of Senate Bill 131. As committee counsel stated, this is merely definitional. It is an important definition because the creating the payment plan that we spoke of in law, the court can create a payment plan if the defendant shows an inability to pay, or the court can delegate it to a supervising authority. The term supervising authority isn't defined, and this provides a definition. This is important because the it's unclear whether or not the supervising authority or who has the ability to modify a payment plan. So the court may establish a payment plan, and then that may become over time not appropriate. The person can get a better job, whatever. So this allows the people that are defined here to modify the payment plan as imposed by the court. The Oregon Judicial Department would also like stricken from that. The supervising authority shall be is authorized to modify the payment schedule, also to collect payments, and they believe that might interfere with the proper dispersal of the payments back into the court system and then through the various categories.
Thank you. Questions? Thank you. Amy, you're on. Prizes for brevity.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I could not have said it any better myself. Amy Alconich, Oregon Criminal Defense Lawyers Association. We support this bill and happy to be up here saying that because we believe that allowing supervising authority to modify payment plans will result in fewer violations, save court time, defense attorney time, and district attorney time, and they best know the resources of the individual. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Questions from the committee? Close the hearing on Senate Bill 131. Open the hearing on Senate Bill 127. Is that what I said?
Yeah.
No, excuse me. I meant 133. Yeah, Senate Bill 133.
Thank you.
Thank you, everybody on the code here, counsel.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members of the committee. Senate Bill 133 actually relates to an issue that Mr. Boss just discussed, about inheritances that a prisoner may receive while they're incarcerated. And what it purports to do is to say that basically you cannot disclaim property under different statutes that exist. It specifically provides that a disclaimer of property is a transfer of property under another law. What it means is a debtor will sometimes disclaim an inheritance in order to avoid having to use the money to pay outstanding obligations to pay creditors. And this bill would be a means of not allowing that to happen.
Mr. Boss.
Chair Burdick, members of the committee, my name is Fred Boss. I'm Chief Counsel of the Civil Enforcement Division of the Oregon Department of Justice. I'm here to testify in support of Senate Bill 133. Senate Bill 133 would eliminate the disclaimer of an inheritance if it would result in the failure of a debtor to be able to pay their debts. A disclaimer of an inheritance is an estate planning tool, and sometimes if someone who is receiving an inheritance may not want to receive it because of the tax consequences. Why are we bringing this? Why is the Restitution Reform Task Force bringing this particular bill? Is that we had a case where a prisoner was set to receive a sizable inheritance. If the prisoner had received it, he would have been able to fulfill his restitution obligation to his victim. He specifically did not want his victim to receive any money, so he disclaimed the inheritance, and all the money then went to his sister. So what this bill does is that in the situation where do that, where you disclaim your inheritance, if it would be essentially like a fraudulent conveyance, which would render you insolvent, and we referenced into the Uniform Fraudulent Conveyance Act, so we have standards already set for insolvency and transfers of this sort, so you already can't make transfers and make yourself insolvent in order to avoid creditors. That's already something that you can't do under the law. This just makes the disclaimer of an inheritance one of those types of transfers.
Thank you. Yeah. Questions from the committee?
This is a good one, Madam.
Senator Pozanski, do you like this bill?
It's okay.
We have Susan Miller signed up to testify.
Susan is with the Department of Justice, and I asked her to appear because she is our resident expert in estate and other matters. And so if the committee has any questions, she knows everything.
Okay. Questions? Close the hearing on Senate Bill 133. Open the public hearing on Senate Bill 127. Counsel.
Thank you, Chair Burdick and members of the committee. Senate Bill 127, again, relates to an issue that we've touched on numerous times today. Senator Pozanski was talking about it briefly. It has to do with priority of payment of different awards of money, compensatory fines, restitution, those two. Compensatory fine is supposed to act like punitive damages in a sense, civilly. It's a penalty. Restitution is supposed to be paid for economic damages, lost wages or income, car damage, etc. Right now, compensatory fines are category one, meaning they are paid before anything else. Restitution is category two, meaning it is split equally with other obligations such as court fees, etc. This Senate Bill 127 would allow a court to designate economic damages awards as compensatory fines and thereby making them first priority for payment.
Thank you. Mr. Boss.
Chair Burdick, members of the committee, my name is Fred Boss. I'm Chief Counsel of the Civil Enforcement Division of the Oregon Department of Justice. I'm here to testify in support of Senate Bill 127. Senate Bill 127 allows the court flexibility when addressing and allows them to direct a payment in a more expedient manner to a victim of a crime. I like other elements in our package, this is a practice in many of the courts in the state. And what it would do is, in the proper circumstance, that the court could designate a restitution of what had been shown to be restitution as, in fact, compensatory damages. And those compensatory damages go for every dollar paid in, so a dollar is paid out to the victim, whereas in the restitution award, for every dollar paid in, that potentially is 50-50-50. An advantage to this bill over the present system is that the court would make an express finding, I am doing this. I'm taking what is restitution and awarding it as a compensatory fine. That brings everything above board. It also would have a tax advantage to the victim, for compensatory fines are punitive fines. They are taxable. Restitution is just getting back what you were out of pocket, and therefore is not taxable.
Madam Chair.
Senator Pisanski.
Good bill should pass.
Okay. We will close. Are there questions from the committee? Such enthusiasm. We will close the hearing on...
Just a couple of others.
Senate Bill 127. Is there any other business before the committee? Judiciary is adjourned. Thank you very much.
Well, okay. You knocked that out.